such a good turnout in St Andrews. My name's Alistair Moffat. It's my pleasure to chair this session. I understand that most of you young people spend quite a lot of your day being talked at by people for an hour, so we won't do that. What we'll do is our four panellists will talk to you for about 5 minutes, and then we can have a discussion which will involve everyone. Now, this is being recorded, and there's a roving mic, I believe, so if you've got a question or an issue or a comment that you'd like to raise, please wait for the mic. I'd like to introduce our four panellists. On my left is the wonderful, 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 wonderful Jenny Brown. Jenny and I invented the Edinburgh Festival Fringe together. Jenny then went on to invent the Edinburgh International Book Festival, which is the biggest in the world, and the Fringe is the biggest festival. We just did big, Jen. Big was a theme. And then Jenny became literature director of the Arts Council when it was a proper Arts Council and interested in the arts. Don't write that down, Ricky. And now Jenny is one of Britain's leading literary agents. To Jenny's left is Richard DeMarco, a hero of mine. Ricky was on the art scene before your parents were thought of. Some time ago, he invented the Traverse Theatre. He invented the DeMarco Gallery. Ricky basically brought modern art single-handedly in a suitcase from Poland one day to Scotland. He's that wonderful thing that they only really have in Europe. Ricky is an animateur. He's a man who makes things happen. And he's been doing that all of an amazingly productive life. He's also an artist of great note, creator of wonderful watercolours and pen and ink drawings of uncharacteristic control, Ricky, I think, your painting and your drawing. But Ricky is very welcome. On my right, I've got Kenny Anderson from Fence Records, from Anstruther. They've been going for 5 years, Kenny, I think?
Probably nearer 15.
Nearer 15. thank you very much for the briefing notes. And been nominated for the Mercury Music Prize. And like Ricky, someone who makes things happen, but in a different art form, in music. To Kenny's right is Lee French, who's the editor of this excellent magazine, Variant, which there are some free copies. There's a limit to largesse, I think. And the editorial in this edition is The Recent Future of Scottish Art, which I suggest, Lee, couldn't be more appropriate to this evening's discussion. I know you didn't write it, but you did publish it, so there'll be a short quiz on what's in it. But Lee is very welcome to join in this discussion. So why don't we start off with you, Lee, and you know, a kind of 5 minute statement, and then we'll all do it, and then we'll try and involve everybody else.
Okay. We're asked to basically summarise our cultural practices in that 5 minutes. I can claim to be an artist, researcher, editor and administrator of Variant magazine. Along with others in 96, I helped relaunch the magazine. And today, Variant is a purposefully free, multi-layered, artist-run magazine which brings creative practices, academic research and public discourse together for dissemination to the widest possible public within our means. Variant's principal editorial is based in Glasgow. Each issue of the magazine is approached as an artist-led project in its own right, initiated and run in collaboration with a changing group of practitioners. As an artist-led group practice, Variant is quite lonely in publicly locating and developing critical cultural discourse in Scotland. Artists' research into and experiments with alternative forms of social organisation can be historically traced and understood to be just as important as traditional research into materials, processes, and products. Variant represents a highly self-reflective area of creative work, with a long and rich history linking video, performance, mail art, self-publishing, institutional critique, installation art, alternative and artist-run spaces, and much, much more. Offering such an intradisciplinary vision or lexicon of arts practice, Variant seeks to publicly participate in and understand culture in the round. That is, in the many and various ways culture exemplifies, illuminates, and engages with larger societal processes. Variant existed for 10 years prior to its relaunch as a glossy new media magazine in receipt of not insubstantial Scottish Arts Council funding before the funding was withdrawn. Since its relaunch, Variant has been a largely voluntary organisation, by which I mean for most of the 15 years, I have been technically unemployed. Being unemployed at all is, of course, getting that much harder with the enforcement of workfare, to say nothing of surviving on such sums. Criticality has been and remains a struggle in Scotland, but that's not unique to here alone. Variant is clearly shaped by its policy context as a space of mediated public communication. In that sense, Variant is not countercultural, nor does it set out to be oppositional, but neither is it mere aesthetic preference, nor part of a tradition of truce and consensus politics, playing along the lines of the state in the reproduction of cultural values. What is Variant then? We, the aggravated I. This cooperative pooling process of self-institutionalization, of social doing. To borrow from Copenhagen Free University, quote, of all the affairs we participate in, with interest or without interest, the groping search for new ways of life is the only aspect still impassioning. The aesthetic disciplines have proved blatantly inadequate in this regard and display the greatest detachment when it comes to the basic questions. But the way forward is not to disband the aesthetic disciplines. The way forward is to demand more from them. In our search for new ways of life, the chemistry of unhappy consciousness and surplus energy is still making us establish experimental institutions and still making us reformulate a discourse within which we apply the word aesthetics. One voice in a mumble of voices. We are not two or three individuals. We are an institution drifting through various social relations in the process of being produced and producing.
Thanks, Lee. I should also have said that if you haven't got a paper copy of the magazine, it also exists online. Mm-hmm. And what's the
Variant.org.uk.
Thank you very much. Jenny.
Hi, everybody. I wanted to spend my 5 minutes by bringing you up to date with what's been happening in the book business. Now, even if this doesn't impact you directly as a writer or a publisher, it very much will do as readers. I recently spent a day at the Society of Authors in Scotland's conference, and the event was designed to bring writers up to date about e-books, about social networking, promotion and self-publishing. We're living through this enormous period of change in the book business. Publishers describe it as a perfect storm, as the rule book on how books are published, purchased and read has just been ripped apart. We've had the near collapse of high street bookselling, and the jury really is still out what's going to happen with Waterstones. Will it survive under James Daunt's leadership? We all need it to. The sharp increase of book sales on Amazon and on the internet and in supermarkets, the advent of e-books, plus a worldwide recession. And this is the first time economic downturn has had an impact, a negative impact on book sales. In every other recession, book sales have actually held steady or actually increased. So all this, of course, has had a profound change and impact on writers. Advances have dropped, sometimes by as much as 2/3. The low prices of books sold on Amazon or in supermarkets mean a much smaller percentage available for writers. And sometimes an author's share of a book sold on Amazon, if it's a very low price, can be as little as 10 pence. Plus, as we discovered in a survey just yesterday, although the rise in e-book sales is compensating for the fall in print book sales in volume terms, in value terms, an e-book is on average sold for £1.50 less than a paperback. And what we're reading is actually changing too. The market for serious history and biography is dropping away. Genre fiction is dominating the bestseller charts and library borrowing as never before, especially crime and thrillers, especially Scandinavian crime and thrillers. And this tendency towards genre is exacerbated in e-book sales. Now, wave your hands vigorously because I otherwise won't see you. How many of you here read books on Kindle or on iBook? No, yeah, a few. Not very many. Well, I'm sorry to tell you that The Guardian last week described you as a furtive beast. Because if you're a Kindle user or reading books on an e-reader, nobody, of course, can tell what you're reading. And apparently this encourages to go down market. And we download paranormal romance, science fiction, and in very big quantities, erotica. Nobody knows what you're reading. All this has led to a trade which feels like it's lost its confidence. We see mainstream publishers banking on what they perceive to be surefire successes, averse to risk, and it's especially hard with literary fiction. So it's no small surprise that small independent publishers had a significant number of titles on the Man Booker long list and on the recent NBA National Book Award list in the States. However, against this very uncertain backdrop, there are some significant opportunities. At that conference, crime writer Lynn Anderson proclaimed that there's never been a better time to be an author because for the first time, you have a choice as an author. My fellow agent and noir writer Alan Guthrie gave a wonderful address then about his own experience of publishing novellas as e-books. After a very slow start, he's now sold 50,000 e-books in a year, a period when his print sales with his publisher amounted to just a few hundred. I've got a senior crime writer I represent whose some of her early books have been out of print for 25 years, and she's steadily selling 800 copies of her earlier titles a month as e-books. So wonderful for her to have readers of her work for the first time in all that time. Now, it wasn't so very long ago that publishers' publicity departments would do most of the work for you in promoting a new book, but not so now. An historical novelist, Sarah Sheridan, stated that writers should devote one whole day a week to promotion, to planning events, to chasing publishers, to chasing press, to liaising with publishers, blogging, etc. So all this activity, of course, is eating very acutely into writers' time to actually write. My term came at the end of that day under the publishing panel, and I guess that I was there with publishers to justify why writers really still need agents and publishers in this new digital age. So I asked for a show of hands at the end of my session to say how many people who didn't have an agent would want an agent, and only three people in the audience thought they could do it alone. But since that event took place, the senior publisher I was on the panel with has now been made redundant. You know, another sign of the times. So that's the kind of general context for writers, but there's a specifically Scottish context too, because traditionally writers north of the border have been in a much more fortunate position than their counterparts in England because of the extraordinary support that traditionally has been available here. So we've got money for writers' centres in Inverness. We've got new writers' bursary scheme for people who've never written before, never had publication before. That's available through the Scottish Book Trust. There's writing residency post, there's a live literature scheme, which means that writers get out and about talking at schools, at writers' groups, etc. And of course, there's the 40 plus literature festivals around Scotland, of which Alistair looks after two, which allow new writers and established writers a platform and a chance just to meet their readers. And it's also a very important place to be able to sell books because, unlike Waterstones, unlike the supermarkets, unlike Amazon, at literature festivals, on the whole, books are sold at full price. And don't underestimate the value of that to writers. There was an interesting feature in the List magazine, some of you might have seen earlier this month, about the state of Scottish literature. And Alan Bissett argued that the grassroots of Scottish literature scene is dynamic and vibrant, with a really lively spoken word scene, and it's transformed by the response to social media and changes in the publishing climate. And I would back this up every day as an agent. I read submissions which have been made to the agency from new writers, so I know that there's a talented generation of writers coming through, partly fostered by the creative writing courses offered at universities like St Andrews, Dundee, etc. So there's support for writers at that early stage of their career, but I do worry about the viability of writing careers now. Traditionally, many writers have combined writing alongside other work. My predecessor at the Scottish Arts Council always held up the model of Angus Martin, who's a brilliant writer in Argyll, who's a postman. So he delivered his letters in the morning, got it out the way, and then concentrated his writing. But a lot of creative writers also write journalism. That's drying up. Teaching posts are scarce. And I fear that Creative Scotland, for all its support for collaborative projects, isn't as forthcoming as the old Scottish Arts Council was when it comes to bursary support for a substantial writing project. Now, I'll just end by saying just a tiny bit about the publishing scene. For far too long, the publishing scene here has been a relatively static one. And for years, I saw the same faces I first encountered when I started out at the Edinburgh Book Festival in 1983. But that's changing a bit. And the sort of people coming to publishing now are changing, arriving without the same preconceptions. There's Mark Buckland from Cargo Publishing, who's already making a real impact with his mix of publishing and live events, and he's just about to run the Margins Festival in Glasgow. Adrian Searle, whose Freight Publishing is concentrating on literary fiction, both short stories, unusually, and novels. Bob Davidson of Sandstone Press, based up in Dingwall, whose novel on the Man Booker long list gave us all a reason to cheer small independent publishers last year. And of course, Jamie Bing of Canongate, who continues to lead and innovate with a string of brilliant successes to its name, from Barack Obama, Mighty Bush, and the Man Booker winning Life of Pi. However, I can't help wondering, do we in Scotland have the publishers that this country deserves? Given off the wealth, the fabulous wealth of writing talent, given the sheer scale and vibrancy of literary activity and our illustrious literary history, aren't we short of just one or two more brilliant publishers able to operate not just on a Scottish scene, but also on a national and international scene? I'm going to leave it for there.
Thank you, Jen. Thank you very much. So you'd advocate a career move from popular history to erotica?
Yes, okay. In your case, Alistair.
No. Well, okay, well, that's, thank you, that's cleared that up. Ricky, do you want to carry on?
Well, you've given me much food for thought, Jenny. I, unfortunately, have not the time or the words to explain why I feel at home here. But I was asked to be rector twice, and I was a runner-up once, and it really pained me to see that the comedian was voted as rector. This university needs someone like Alistair, who really does care about education, and I think you're all very lucky to have him as your rector.
Thank you, Richard.
I have no qualifications whatsoever in the arts. I mean, I'm the last person in the world to run a theatre or put on an exhibition. I have no qualifications, none. I'm a school teacher, and I'm very happy to be a school teacher, teaching people from 5 years of age to 18, whatever it is, while they're at school. But I found the classroom within the concept of education in this country to be restrictive. So I decided that the classroom would become a mixture of what was called the paperback bookshop. That's where it began, in a bookshop.
Charles Street.
Right in the middle of the university campus, run by an American who did the inexcusable thing of offering everybody who came in there a free coffee. Yeah. Dan Harrell, 1960. I'm going back a long time. I'm not going back as far as the origin of the Edinburgh Festival, which is 1947. But I think I've got to mention it. For some unbelievable reason, I was a schoolboy then, and I was I was obliged to attend some of the most amazing events that any human being would ever, ever enjoy. Changed my life. I failed my French at school because my French teacher couldn't speak French. I hadn't the faintest idea what it sounded like, French language. And imagine 1947 to be there when the greatest theatre company, French-speaking, the Comédie Française, was performing Molière's L'École des Femmes. Oh my God, did I fall in love with the French language? And did I feel totally dissatisfied with this thing called English? And I was so happy that this institution called the Edinburgh Festival was entirely international. Now, 1947 was 2 years after the war. So the last thing you would have expected was that all the music was dedicated to Germany. Why not? The one country that's produced the greatest composers imaginable. And therefore, it it supported the theme, which was that we did had to do something to heal the wounds of war, which was searing and open and full of blood. And so Edinburgh was chosen to have this incredible festival, and totally international, completely about one thing, that the language of art is the language of healing. Now, so many years passed before I decided I couldn't stand it any longer, going to see all these amazing things and having to be a member of an audience. I mean, it was too much for me to watch the 18-year-old Maggie Smith perform in a wonderful play, Swedish play. And I'm thinking, God, this is an amazing young woman beginning her career at Oxford. I can't believe that this extraordinary grand dame now dominating so many aspects of British theatre on television and whatever. But the Edinburgh Festival transformed Edinburgh from being a city without an opera house. By the way, its reputation in the 30s and the 20s, between the wars, was a city resistant to culture. I mean, the pubs closed at whatever. There was no place to go to.
It still is outside the festival.
I want you to know that it seemed inevitable that my classroom, because I used to read Catcher in the Rye, J.D. Salinger, to my children, because, you know, I'd just been given a copy, and I thought, hey, thank you, Jim, for that copy. I should read this to the children. They were completely spellbound by the adventures of this young man. I used to put on the music. Oh, I'm supposed to be teaching. I came to London. I'd just seen the premiere of West Side Story. Oh, I didn't want to keep that music to myself, so I played it. But I said, if you behave yourselves, and you become like me, well, I want every single child in this school to believe that they're an artist. I didn't know that I was actually thinking the thoughts of somebody called Joseph Beuys, who arguably was the greatest artist of the 20th century, and who replaced Picasso, what's his name? Pablo? replaced the idea that an artist simply makes masterpieces all the time. How boring. Every time you go anywhere near a tablecloth, you quit a drawing that's suddenly worth thousands of pounds. Beuys didn't say that. Beuys was a survivor of the war. Beuys was on the wrong side during the war. He was fighting for the Luftwaffe. At the end of it, he had half a skull. He had only one lung. He was already dying. He knew his days were numbered. The best thing that happened to me was I decided to say no to the New York art world. For some reason, you see, I was invited to be the guest of the American government when New York was the place to be, where all the greatest artists, and I knew that was a lie. I knew that the culture of the 20th century of modernism was coming from Europe. And strangely enough, I was fortunate enough to come upon a city which had just survived the war, be bombed to smithereens by the Royal Air Force. I hated the war, and I hated the thought of Dresden completely smashed, fire destroying thousands and thousands of civilians. I hated the fact that we won the war in the end by dropping a couple of atomic bombs in the middle of the day, you know, without warning. I just want to know that the arts are, as Beuys has said, the one language we have to take seriously. For God's sake, don't take seriously the language of politicians. It's third rate. And certainly don't take seriously the language of bankers. Don't bring the whole structure of society down so that you will inherit this mess. I hate the idea that Greece, the country that has produced our civilization, is accused of being a worthless, difficult, impossible situation, and we've got to save it, us. People like us. And why are we uniting the concept of European countries under the name of, what's it called? The Euro. Pathetic. The thing that links people, that enables us to use the language of love to identify ourselves in relation to everybody else, is the language of all the great writers, all the great poets, all the great composers, all the great musicians, all the great actors, everyone who can be defined eventually as someone who utilizes the language of love. Without it, the language of healing, we are lost. So, I don't know how I've survived since 1947, against the machinations of my mortal enemy, which is the Arts Council, or whatever it's called now. What's it called now?
Creative Scotland.
Creative Scotland. That means everything up to now has been the opposite of creative. We needed Creative Scotland to tell us that we could be creative. I don't believe that. I wonder how many Christmas cards the members of that Creative Scotland board received from artists. That's how you judge a human being. Many points, you know. How many people do you think you could work with so that you could present something called a theatre production? I have presented over 3,000 theatre productions without a penny from the Arts Council. I'm very proud of that. And when the Travers began, of course, the Arts Council wouldn't go anywhere near his door. It was scared rigid by the idea of truth being made manifest under the name of one of the world's greatest theatres. It wasn't a Scottish theatre. It was a theatre that produced God knows how many world premieres in heaven knows how many languages by people who had never been heard of because they were, Romanian, Bulgarian, Polish, French, Italian. Oh, by the way, I must explain, as I stand here before me, I have never wakened up once in my life thinking, thank God I'm blessed, I live in Scotland. I'm waking up in Scotland. No. I always think, with a name like Ricardo De Marco, that's my real name. My mother said, don't use that word, Ricardo, it's too much. You'll never get anywhere. Just be a simple Richard. Give them a hope that you're part of whatever Scotland is. Anyway, I've lived all my life by working with artists, thousands and thousands of them, in Europe. And this University of St. Andrews means nothing to me, absolutely nothing, if you think of it as a Scottish university. And I know your job is going to be to place it absolutely right in the middle of what a great European university is all about. At one time, as a serious student, you begin your studies at somewhere like Oxford or Cambridge or the Sorbonne, but you would eventually see that that was all part of a network which included St. Andrews, a great and noble institution that gave Scotland, to a certain extent, every right to call itself superior in terms of education. But we must be very careful, because even this institution is run, like all our universities now, by how much money can be made from the intake of students. I think that's disgusting. I lived most of my life thinking that universities were the places where you could know what it was to be possessed of freedom. Freedom to study whatever you wanted, to say what you wanted, to work with people in terms of theatre. God, the number of theatre productions I've put on under the name of this university at the Edinburgh Festival. The number of people I've known who are my good friends over many years who've been educated here. I want you to know that I'm speaking to an audience here, not of university undergraduates, but of artists. Okay, I'll finish by just asking you to translate from the German. Boys, when I said to him, "What is art for you, Joseph? What is it?" He said, "Okay, I'll tell you. Kunst ist Kapital." Oh God, he's got me. I'm going to make a fool of myself. I'm going to say art is money. But it isn't. Because he knew that Kapital meant something different in German. And there's an older word in English, which is Anglo-Saxon, and it's wealth. Art is wealth. Oh, well, that means money, doesn't it? No, it doesn't. Rethink it. If you use the word common wealth, it means common, it means the health of society. Art is the language which, if you get it wrong, if you misuse it, it will destroy society, it will become a pollution. But if you get it right, it will make society healthy. It will show society to be in a fit condition to be taken seriously. That's why I'm so pleased that this event has taken place and that so many of you are here. I now have hopes for the future of this university, and I'd like you to know that when anyone asks you what is art, would you please tell them, Kunst ist Kapital, and then ask them to translate. If you ask many of your teachers here, I bet you they'll find it difficult to reply. But I've told you a truth, and that's how you judge everyone you'll ever meet. He also said, and I think it's true, everyone is an artist. And I remember the music master at my school saying, you and I are going to turn every single boy here, all 260 of them, into artists. I thought, oh God, we'll get a sack. Because the parents will say, our children are here to become lawyers, accountants, sensible human beings, members of the Scottish Arts Council. Respectable, something you can trust. I don't want to become artists, but you know who he was? This guy who was teaching music alongside me. He was the director of the chorus of the Paris Conservatoire and the London Philharmonic, and the founder of the Edinburgh Festival Chorus. And therefore, his job was to take ordinary children, especially all of those who were tone deaf, and cause them all to sing as part of a fantastic chorus. And that was the origin of the Edinburgh Festival Chorus. And I thought to myself, I don't need any more proof that what goes on in a school can actually affect the world's greatest manifestation of culture. So take art seriously. Protect this amazing society. Go out as far as you can and say to everyone who is not a member, why are you not a member? Because it's the most important manifestation that all is well with St. Andrews. And I drink to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ricky. Thank you very much indeed.
I can't follow that.
You're going to have to, Kenny.
Well, if you are going to go about saying Kunst ist Kapital, maybe not have a lager shandy because I had to struggle with. I don't want to get arrested by the swear police. Okay, well, I wear two hats in my recording life. I'm signed to Domino Records, who have the Arctic Monkeys, they have Franz Ferdinand, the Wild Beasts. And until this year, with Domino Records and with Warner Brothers before that, I had to make albums just for less and less money and do more and more work and more sort of non-art, which is promotion. Just a load of nonsense, really, to try and sell records that were costing less and less to make. The biggest threat, I think, to the... Well, it's interesting that the literature world is now facing what the music industry has suffered for the last decade. The record industry is on its knees, thanks to Spotify, thanks to Facebook, MySpace. People who think that it's their right to own every album and to have it on their laptop for free, that's killed it. YouTube is killing it. And bizarrely, Fence Records, this is my other hat, that has kind of grown against this complete shelving of your record industry. Now, you might think you don't need music. You can get it from anywhere in the world. You could go online. You could find music from anywhere on the planet other than maybe Borneo. And you're going to get it for free. Well, you're going to trawl through a hell of a lot of shite to find something you like. And you won't find something you like because as the record industry plummets, there's no mediator, there's no taste control, there's nobody investing in decent recordings. So what you're going to have in the next, say, maybe a decade, is you will find all the music you like for free, it's just going to be rubbish. And all the bands that you do like, you'll wonder why they don't play within a train ride of where you are. So take St Andrews, where do you go to see a live gig other than when King Creasel comes to town? But where do you go? Dundee's finished. Edinburgh maybe, but no, maybe not outside the fringe. Glasgow is pretty much it if you want to see bands. In my Fence Records life, we are sort of committed to, for the last 15 years we have basically tried to add value back to music and to recordings. So if you don't value something, it is going to disappear. If you start, now I know this Kindle thing, I saw a horrible advert where the Kindle manufacturers were offering £20 for, well, off a Kindle if you sent them any book. So that's quite devious, really. That's like saying, let's get books out of circulation and sell this gadget. I know of somebody who, within a weekend of owning a Kindle, had downloaded free 4,000 books. And this is a guy who only read maybe, I don't know, a Dan Brown once every 3 years. But now he's got all these books, he's got too much to read. What happens there? That's he's got all those books, he doesn't have to buy any books. His circle of friends certainly don't have to buy any books. So really with Fence, we're trying to teach this lesson that if you value something, you have to either pay for that or you have to devote some of your time to that, but don't expect to sit at home with your fastest broadband connection and just absorb it all without giving anything back. That's hopeless. So yeah, with Fence Records, we've made the bold move of going back to vinyl only. Most of you won't even know what to do with slab of vinyl. Anybody born in the late 80s? Your good self. So you might remember vinyl as a, yeah. Vinyl's ace. Vinyl is the best music reproduction you'll get. You need a good turntable and good speakers, but it is the best. CD is compressed and not as good. The worst music that you're all listening to is MP3. It's horrible. No bass end. It's super compressed. And anybody who tells you that once you've got your music on iTunes or on your laptop, that's it forever, that's wrong. Because when you change your computer, you'll find all your music's tied to your old computer. And, well, you all know about iPod crash. And so, yeah, that's my little rant. I think the biggest danger to art is the internet and the downloading culture. And everybody wants everything now. Within an hour, we want all the books we'll ever want. We want all our videos. We want all films. We want all albums. It has to be now. And then we'll decide later whether we're going to invest any time in that collection. But most people don't. And I think Facebook is an abomination. to bring Spotify back into it. People think that if you buy off Spotify, you're actually doing the artist a favour rather than taking it for free. Well, that's bullshit as well, because at my current rate of Spotify payment, it's going to take me 125 years to earn the minimum £100. So that'll probably go to my great-grandson, and I think 100 quid then probably won't get him an ice cream. So, yeah, good luck.
Well, thank you, Ken. Okay, well, let's open this up to you guys. You've listened to four excellent presentations. Let's have some questions. There's a roving mic, so can you please wait for that before you ask your question? Oh, come on, guys, you're all very shy.
Can we just have normal lighting here?
Yeah, can we put the house lights up? Because it's very difficult to see. Okay, who's got a comment then, if not a question? Well, there's someone there in the middle of the left-hand side. Thank you.
Hi. So there's been a lot of talk about how books and music are being affected by the internet and download culture, as you said. But I also can't help but feel that the internet is also making those things more accessible to a lot of people. So I wondered if you think there's a way that you can use the internet and harness the internet, because it's kind of here to stay, in order to benefit the book and music industry and other things as well.
Thank you, Kenny. You want to feel?
Yeah, that? Well, already there's laws coming in now that stop you. I mean, the French were ahead of the curve when they realised that the French record industry has always been sort of very, very much about France, in that they had a policy that a high percentage of French radio had to be French acts. So they were very aware of what was happening with people ripping albums, passing them around to friends, taking music off Napster or whatever it was. So they started to bring in laws that the householder, whoever was the nominal head of that broadband connection, if they were found to be downloading illegally, then there was a warning. If they did it twice, their broadband got capped from high speed to the one below. If they got caught again, it went back to dial-up. And if they got caught again, there was a fine and the internet was switched off. So now you're finding that in the US, this is big money that's getting lost now. So it was kind of fine when it was only, you know, the music industry, the major labels, because they could afford it. They barged ahead thinking the internet would, that same argument that this would open their market, the internet all over the world would give them even more customers. But what they forgot was that once you do that, you're competing with the whole world. No, it's not the whole world coming to you, it's you having to shout even louder against everybody else that's shouting to the whole world. And then that cobbled against like Russia is the worst country for illegal downloading. In fact, any new album that comes out in the UK within about 3 to 4 days after the record has gone out as a promo, i.e. once it's gone to radio press, you will get that album on a Russian website absolutely free. So there's no international law, but that's, I think, what the US are trying to bring in now. They want an international law because there's huge sums of money now being lost. And it's, of course, it's now threatening your freedom of speech. So hence the whole Wikipedia closing down. The best quote I heard about that was, where am I going to get my inaccurate information now? Nonsense. Who noticed Wikipedia going down for a day? Nobody. This is the thing. In order to control,
a lot of people are writing essays, you know.
Yeah. In order to control and police the internet, it basically means everybody's ISP address or what have you is known, and that's what people are resisting. But at some point, it will. It's all about money. And at some point, when there's more money to be made by you getting less or getting, and they'll try it in all sorts of ways. They're trying to say now that it's a language problem. It's better that if you're, you know, in Indonesia, that the websites that you can access are all in your language rather than go worldwide. So the internet is already getting divvied up. I heard a horrible story that there's actually another internet that the that exists within the internet that and you can't get to it by putting Google into Google, but apparently the criminal underclasses, they've all got this other internet that you can get an access to, and that's where all the big business is done and all this. So yeah, I think the governments know what's going on. It's a horrible, horrible thing, the internet. I met in Crail, believe it or not, I met a spy, MI5, and I asked him what his job was. I'm a massive sort of fan of the James Bond and the sort of all the cloak and dagger, and I asked him what his job was, and he said basically he was an IT guy, and the biggest threat to a country's security is like European hackers. So he spends his whole day basically trying to improve firewalls, because like everyone else, the MI5 decided to put all the records into some digital form, lose all the paper copies, and now they're just continually protecting. So it was quite an eye-opener to know that everything, now this, you might think, yeah, who cares, MI5, but it's all the banking stuff, it's everything in there. So yeah, the internet, boo, down with the internet, switch off, cut off your Facebook page, that's all CIA owned. That's another thing about art, like who owns the art? If you put all your photographs up on your Facebook page and any ideas you've had and songs you've written and prose and this and that and other, you forget that you don't own any of this. You've signed it all away. So you get to the end of your life, you won't have a collection of photographs that us old doofers have. We've got photographs in boxes that are ours. You won't own anything. You won't own any of that music that you wrote and shoved up on Facebook. There'd be nothing there. And then what does it take to collapse the internet? There's people working on it all the time. Like China is trying to shut down the UK. And it's horrible. That was from the spy.
Okay, well.
But yeah, I think that's the big danger today, is that there's this diversions now about people who choose to go down the internet route and have this music as an app on your phone. You spend £5 a month and you get whatever crap, you know, is still able to be recorded in the studios. You can get that on your phone, or you opt out. And I'm somebody who opted out. And Fence Records, we put on real events. We sell vinyl. We try and get our custom base one at a time. And for us, our internet page is basically a flash advert. That's all it is.
So you heard it in Crail. Thank you. Lee, isn't the internet good from your point of view, though, in the sense that many more people, I suspect, will read the magazine online than read paper copies? So it's been the opposite of Kenny's experience to some extent for you, hasn't it? And for others?
Yes. I mean, it's given us an international reach that we wouldn't have had otherwise. It also has put us in contact with other people, like-minded or otherwise, that we wouldn't have otherwise. At the same time, my biggest problem with the internet is not being able to afford it. The idea that the internet is bad, inflation is worse.
But would you not have if you had a newspaper and it's, you sold it in local news agents, which there used to be, just like when there used to be record shops, you would have that same audience, they would just be local.
We, 15 years ago, we did studies as to why to bring out the magazine for free with no cover price. And we worked out, first of all, there was nowhere to sell it in Scotland, and there still isn't. It's actually worse today than it was then. And the other point was that it would actually cost us more to sell it and attempt to recoup the money of people and our time than to give it away for free. And apart from that, a lot of the work that's already done within it is actually within academia. And as a transfer of knowledge from academia to a public that the public has already paid for by and large, we felt would, unlike certain large publishing groups, be rather nasty to try and charge people for it twice or three times. So the reason for acting as an intermediary in certain cases between academia and a wider public that would ordinarily receive that research, see that research, was precisely that, give it away for free. But as I say, I seriously had to consider whether we could actually afford an internet connection this summer. We've also never received any support whatsoever in developing the website or web technology at all, unlike in England. But having said that, Mute magazine in London has recently had 100% cut from the Arts Council of England. Now, a magazine that came out of new media, art and technology, and is central to it, is indicative of how the technology is being absorbed into larger organisations purely for promotional purposes. And I think there's a lot of issues around governance, around regulation, around an industry around regulation, a spy industry around regulation, which St Andrews University is clearly also part of that industry. So there's a whole set of issues there, as we know.
Okay. Okay. Any more questions from anyone?
I'm going a little bit back to the music part. Do I need this?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. And it's also the same in, it might be in books, I don't know, but at least in film and television, you operate in territories, and so you'll get one CD in Europe, but not in the US and the other way around. And for me, it's, I've started to pay for my music now, because it's so convenient on my iPod and on my iPhone and my Mac, and I just go and then I get it and I'm really happy. But when it comes to TV shows, and I watch a lot of TV shows and I pay attention, they're not available in Europe at all. So I can't get them. I can wait 6 months, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to get it illegally. So I'm wondering if you've started to reconsider this idea of sort of limiting it in terms of geography when it's all digital anyway. Because I think a lot of people would pay if they could get it easy and right away.
Okay, well, I mean, one of the reasons that TV is problematic is because the US system is different from the PAL system in Britain. But also one of the really big growth areas has been the sale of box sets. And that's very often how people consume American and now Danish TV. They buy box sets because it gives them much, much more control. And you look at some of these sales numbers for things like The Sopranos and The West Wing and The Wire and so on, they are huge because people want to be able to stop it when they want it, when they fall asleep or whatever, and they want control over it. So it's been a big new earner for TV producers, which is what I used to do, so I'm aware of this. But I think the territorialization, if that's a word, of the internet, it all feels like it's, you know, a wall of sand against the tsunami. You know, it's you know, what you're doing is really admirable, but I suspect that not many people are doing that kind of thing. And that they're being drowned by the wave that is the internet. I mean, you think that's fair, Jen?
Yeah, I mean, I would have a rather more Pollyanna view of probably of the internet than you would, because I think the difficulties I've been describing are very much to do with it being quite a new phenomenon for the book industry, and we've just got to get a whole lot of things sorted out. For instance, at the moment, if you're a writer and your book is published as an e-book by a conventional publisher, you'll get at most 25% of the net receipts. And 25% of the net receipts, an average e-book costs £3.39, according to something yesterday in the press. And so you'll get, it'd be 70% that the publisher gets, and you'll get 25% of the 70%, which if anybody who does maths here will know is actually more than I was telling you that you're going to get from an Amazon sale of your paperback. But of course there are great arguments why that 25% should be 50%, and that's what we're all aiming to, and they will cave in, the publishers will cave in. But a great frustration for any writer is the fact that you're up against these gatekeepers. You know, writers, they try to get an agent, somebody like me, and there are not enough agents, or not enough agents taking on new work because we can't sell it. And then if I take you on, then I'm trying to sell you to a publisher, there's another gatekeeper. Now, the option is there now to self-publish. Just put it up on the internet already. Now, your friend, who's downloaded 4,000 books of the weekend for free,
he's not my friend.
Oh, sorry. He's not your friend. And I'm not sure how good a reading experience he's having. If he's having all those books for free. But it has been shown that the cheaper your books are to begin with, the more likely you are to build an audience. The great thing about books for Kindle or other e-book readers is the bookshop's always open 24 hours a day and the shelves are always full. It's a great, yeah.
Well, that's true. That's absolutely true. Okay, back there.
So the arts generate a lot of money for the Scottish economy,
But I was wondering about the more qualitative, the less tangible social values of the arts, and whether they're given much attention when it comes to arts funding. Any ideas?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that if the choice that's always presented is, would you buy a kidney machine or a painting? Well, obviously, you'd buy a kidney machine. And, you know, you're always presented with these sorts of false choices. But if you go back and think about what Ricky was talking about, and the sense of enrichment that the arts in general... I hate the phrase "the arts." It's such a tosser of a phrase. I mean, we all sound like real limp-wristed twits, right? In the arts. I work in the arts.
Oh, God. What a thing to admit.
Exactly. And I've done that all my life, as indeed we all have. But the sense of enrichment of our society, of our culture, and you can see it, you know, like an amazing palimpsest in this town. The sense of enrichment is incalculable. Incalculable. Mm. And that's the layer upon layer of sense of feeling, of love and experience that Ricky was talking about earlier. You feel it, you sense it. It is intangible and really hard to measure. You know, you talk to people from North America, and there are a few Americans here, I think.
Americans? Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Good. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a it's a staggering thought, but they may well be amongst us. But you hear people say, "God, the history that you've got," but what they really mean is the cultural history that we sense around us, and it can manifest itself in all sorts of ways. But mostly, it's intangible and hard to measure. I think one of the great difficulties is and you know, Lee and Ricky and others have mentioned the Arts Council and arts funding and so on, and not exactly in the most positive light. Creative Scotland talk about investments in projects. Investments.
The
language of banking, the language of a different kind of capital from what Joseph Boyce meant.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult to make these quantitative judgments. We, our book festivals, and Jenny did this too, and we did it at the Fringe massively in 1978, when we had 11,000 people interviewed. If you look at the economic impact of what you guys do, it is enormous. It is huge. You can do it very easily with festivals because they're one-off occasions. They have a beginning and a clear end. And, you know, a little book festival that we do in the Borders over 4 days brings in £3.4 million and gets precisely £25,000 worth of public subsidy. Now, you know, we don't buy shares in that. But the thing is, it's actually false. It's the whole experience. Mm. You know, it's not just 4 days of writers. It's all the background behind that. It's Walter Scott, it's Melrose Abbey, it's all of that that comes together. So it's a false set of measurements, I think, in my view. And the best advice you've heard tonight is what Ricky said. You're all artists, all of you. Let me ask you, why are you here? Yeah. I notice, incidentally, that most of you are women. But why are you here? What is it that attracted you about this? Is it because you want to work in the arts, or because you have something to say through an artistic medium, whether it's literature or painting or music?
Good question.
Why are you here? Come on.
All together.
Come on, let's have some comments. What is it that interests you?
I wanted to hear Ricardo de Marcos.
That's why I let him go on, I can tell that. There's a lady. There's a lady who put her hand up there, yeah?
I'm a man.
Yeah. Excellent. Oh, well done.
Well done.
Yeah. Well done.
Don't worry, I get all the time. I actually have a question. We've been getting a lot of negativity from the table. I mean, I understand things are pretty bad, and that's usually, ironically, quite good for the arts. We usually create, you know, very interesting things when things are bad, but does anyone have anything positive to say about the arts? You seem...
So. I'd just like to say that I'm a creature. I mean, I've lived most of my life...
He's standing up. This is not a good sign.
I lived most of my life in an age which didn't understand the meaning of the word computer. I once had breakfast with Marshall McLuhan, and out of his mouth came words, you know, we're living in a global village, and the medium is a message. Oh, God. I had to take that on board. It was in Canada. And I realized that the world's changed dramatically since the 70s, and the Edinburgh Festival has changed with it. And there is the power of the internet that you have to cope with. I myself don't know how to use a computer. I don't know how to do it. Thankfully, I've got a colleague who does the necessary. I have to look at that horrible image, which is electronic. I believe that the most important moment in any of our lives is dealing with another human being or a group of human beings. And that moment is precious. Sacred. And if you get it right, you only need half a dozen people. The Edinburgh Festival was created by four or five people who needed it. The Edinburgh City Council didn't want it, nobody wanted it, but it happened. The paperback bookshop happened with three or four people wanting it, against all the odds. The Travis Theatre, nobody in their right minds would have backed it. The Marco Gallery to get it, the Tale of Sorrow,
and that was just
we're looking
for
positives, Ricky.
Yeah, come on.
Positives.
It was us that had the pain, Ricky.
The question you asked was a vital question. Why are you all here? Is it because you want to find out on earth your dreams meant over the last week? I mean, you know, we all live a life in full wakefulness, but you also have your dreams. And what were they telling you? And how do you respond to them? And how do you deal with the passing of time, which is so amazingly powerful and is happening at the speed of light? The arts are the only way we make sense of that. I mean, I'm now living my life. I used to live it fairly recently in extra time when I was in my 70s. Can you imagine that? Knowing you're playing the game of life an extra time. I'm now playing the game of life in penalty shootout time. For God's sake, I hope all of you live that long, but it's most exciting when you've got to win. And the only way you can win against the onslaught of stupidity, crassness, and corruption is to use the language of art, which endures beyond your lifetime, and is there for every generation. I mean, God, can you imagine living a life without Shakespeare and his use of language? Can you imagine living a life without the sound of Mozart? It's impossible. I know that most people I meet who are politicians don't have time for that sort of nonsense, listening to music, looking at paintings, reading a book, because they are into the moment. I don't think it's enough to spend your time only on what's happening in the last few minutes or the last few days. I think you have to take on board the whole history of ideas. And the human race, which defined the history of ideas, which included Newton and Einstein and all these people, were living, communicating, Molière, everyone, without the use of the computer. So be very careful. I think all of you are going to live long enough, all of you so desperately young, as far as I'm concerned, you're going to live when there'll come a moment when we'll want something better than the so-called communication that human beings have to rely on nowadays. And I think it will go right back to the very basic moment. If you want something to say, you have to have in your mind the idea that you're saying it because there's a human being somewhere, not only one or two, or maybe a dozen, who would want to share your idea. And I think if you keep that in mind and stop thinking in terms of millions, oh, by the way, I hate the idea of a Oscar ceremony. I mean, imagine that. The poor devil would have to receive that ugly thing and say, I'm so happy to have it. I'm so successful now that I've got an Oscar. Oh, what?
You want to pray for them, don't you? Pray that they will not go mad. You'll say, there's more to life than dressing up in your fancy clothes and having to receive something as nonsensical as an Oscar. I think we're into a world where fame and success are up there. When we all know that the arts are about failure. Every single artist that I admire, including Shakespeare, has proved that they can produce something which is a total failure. The worst plays of Shakespeare I'm thinking of, okay? I think we admit our fragility, our humanity, when we can really consider the language of art. And all great artists live a life where chances are they will die in penury or in an unmarked grave, like Vermeer or Mozart or whatever, and they will be misunderstood. So be very careful. When I say you're born to be an artist, also means you're born to defend certain truths that never change from the moment of your birth to the moment of your death. And that is the thing that gives you, how can I say, the energy, the willpower, to continue using the language of art. I know that your rector here is a heavily disguised member of the academic fraternity. You know, the rector of a great and noble university. But he's really an artist. And he's had to work in the world of, oh yes, I'm going to use the word, because there's a difference between art and entertainment. I don't want to be part of the world of entertainment. I don't want to be part of a world where I'm constantly thinking, how do I make people laugh? How do I amuse people? I don't want to do that. I want to be part of a world where I can rely on people to help me understand the truth of what it means to be alive, day by day, 24 hours a day, knowing that life is very short. I know that now. God Almighty, at 81, how many years have you got to plan anything? When in fact everybody you've ever cared for is dead. And you know that despite your greatest efforts, the truth can be easily misread and mutilated. I'm demanding that you do something. Give me greater hope that this university can do something so that when you hear the word St. Andrews as, you know, belonging to a community of human beings, you don't automatically think of golf. That's entertainment. That's about a game being played. I want you to be capable in the coming years. I know that you will leave, is that right? At the end of this year? You shouldn't be allowed to do so. The universities need you desperately. your friends. Because now that you've started this extraordinary institution, it's going to continue. So I know that you're already talking to your successor, of successors, because we should have more gatherings like this. If you don't use the language of art, the chances are, despite all your prizes and even your academic successes, you will end up being a plonker. And I meet so many plonkers, you know, and all their medals and everything else, and Robert Burns knew who they were, and they control things, but they're really plonkers. Because they don't, there's no record of them using, seriously, or not themselves using it, but like my friends here, enabling other people to use the language of art. You've got to do, for every waking hour, for every day of your life, be on duty, like a sentinel, helping people, if they're not using it, to use it, this language. which is the language of the angels, for God's sake. It's the language that we use to write a love letter. When you write a love letter, you're aspiring to the condition of being a poet. When you sing a song or dance a dance, you are probably defining yourself as part of some kind of celebration. And this man is fighting a war. I mean, I know that. I didn't look on his face and see. Thank God he says it.
Got the Wilfredo in here.
I know. And you're fighting a war too. And I recognize serious people in the arts by the fact that they are at the front line between the world of mass entertainment and serious manifestations. What are we talking about? We're talking about the arts. Are we therefore talking about culture? Are we therefore talking about words that are bandied around to be defined only in terms of money? By the way, it's happening in education too. When the arts collapse, the world of education collapses. When I hear that great universities are doing away with the Italian studies, because it doesn't make any money, and more and more people are doing something stupid at university, like heading towards a degree in underwater basket weaving, or computer studies, or business studies, or all that nonsense. How many people here are studying philosophy? Wow. I'm delighted. Please tell Professor Haldane that I asked that question. He's a friend of mine. Okay. How many people here are studying theology or religion? Hands up. Nobody. How many people here are studying some aspect of the history of ideas? One, two. Oh, that's good. Good. I hate the word art. And that look that people give you when you see you in the world of art. They look, oh, God, what a failure. He's not a lawyer. He's not an admiral of the fleet. He's not a TV newsreader. What is this? Oh, God. They couldn't have an employer not warning that it's a nasty thing you carry on your back, the role of the artist. And it does weigh you down. All I can say is, either you're an artist, a creative soul, with the full extent of your being, at least one of you is different, thank God, or you're a conqueror. That means not creative. That means a danger to society. And I hope that there's nobody here who's a danger to society. By the way, I dislike the idea that I'm judged by the fact that people might know me on the internet. That means they don't know me. Okay? The only moment that I know is important in my life, if I can remember the face and the moment of truth when I actually met someone. Look into their eyes, know the difference between the color of their eyes and the texture of their hair and the sound of their voice, and remember that moment when they wanted to share something and they said, let's go to the theater, or let's read a book together. That's the sacred moment. That's so sacred that you want it to be part of your understanding of every child. Okay? Before they are steamrolled into the business, that they're born to be a success, born to be famous. My job has been for the last 50 years to do everything in my power to stop people becoming famous or successful. And that's the world of the arts.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ricky DeMarco. We'll have to stop there, I'm afraid, gang, and I'd like you to join me in thanking Ricky, Jenny, Kenny, and Lee for being with us.